From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, how old is mankind anyway? Michael Cremo joins us, the forbidden archaeologist. Here's what's happening. While we were on the air last night, of course, tragedy and more disruptions in Ferguson, Missouri, two police officers during protests were shot and wounded. The shooting of those two officers was a heinous assault, according to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. Two officers were seriously injured during the protests following the resignation of a police chief after a report of racial bias in that community. Now, the fatal shooting of a black teenager last year, you'll remember that, in Ferguson, sparked protests about the police use of lethal force. But who can blame police officers for being uptight, especially when they're trying to control crowds and somebody shoots them from afar? Police are looking for two individuals. One of them could very well be the suspect. One police officer was wounded, shot through the shoulder. The bullet went right through. The other was shot in the face. The bullet went right underneath his right eye. It still is lodged behind his ear. Fake IRS agents have targeted more than 366,000 people with harassing phone calls, demanding payments, and threatening jail as part of a huge nationwide tax scam that has cost taxpayers already $15.5 million. If you get one of those calls, don't worry about it. More than 3,000 people have fallen for the ruse since 2013. The scam has claimed victims in almost every state. Listen to this. One unidentified victim lost more than $500,000 thinking it was an IRS agent. Jeez. Four of the biggest names on Wall Street struggling to pass the federal tests on whether they're strong or not. They did not have passing grades. Look out, big banks struggling to pass the Fed stress test, as they say. The administration's latest analysis and forecast is for more expensive oil this year and in 2016, and therefore more expensive fuel prices than anticipated than just a couple of months ago. We're already seeing the increase at the gasoline pumps, so not much we can do about that. Best-selling British fantasy author Terry Pratchett has died at the age of 66. Pratchett, who wrote more than 70 books, including those in the Discworld series, had been diagnosed with a very rare form of Alzheimer's disease in 2007. Over 200 people have been arrested in Tanzania as part of a nationwide crackdown on witch doctors, linked to a wave of attacks and murders there. Police say they've arrested 225 unlicensed traditional healers and soothsayers. Frustrated that her three children were spending way too much time glued to the television watching music videos, a 40-year-old Illinois mother fired multiple shots from a Ruger 22 long rifle into the family's 50-inch Panasonic flat-screen television. At the time of the shooting, her three children, ages 6, 11, and 15, were simply watching a music video. People are uptight. As a matter of fact, Webster's Dictionary says they're nervous, worried, tending to become upset about something that does not make other people upset. I thought we'd check in with Howard Bloom, our expert on humanity, about why people are so uptight these days. Howard, why?
Well, first of all, we're all manic depressive. Every one of us has stress attacks over things that we shouldn't. And every one of us periodically is optimistic about things that should drive us crazy. I mean, look at what happened just in the last week or so. We had the best jobs report in 19 years, 295,000 new jobs added. What did that do to the stock market? It dropped it 700 points, like a stone. There were other signs of nervousness. We had 3 months in a row where retail sales were down. We are all subject to this, but there is new information. This just came out, started to come out in November. It came out in the Society for Neuroscience Conference in Washington, D.C., and new research has come out on it this week. There is a system in the brain. If you ever wondered why marijuana works on people, it's because there's a system in the brain that produces a natural form of marijuana. And when that system gets out of whack, when there isn't enough what's called endocannabinoids, endogenous, for all practical purposes, endogenous marijuana-like chemicals, when there isn't enough of that in the brain, then we are uptight. Then we are skittish as all hell. And they are developing now endocannabinoid-based drugs in order to decrease that, because it's also the system, the endocannabinoid system, not only handles anxiety, it handles obesity. So you can use the same drugs to decrease obesity and to decrease anxiety. And there's a new drug, it's in clinical trials now, called trospium, that works on this system, and it works on obesity, it works on anxiety, and it may also work, it's being tested, to see if it works on breast cancer. So there's hope.
Well, we need hope, Howard, that's for sure. But I'm just concerned about just watching the scenes unfold in Ferguson, Missouri, again, echoing almost last year, even worse, with two police officers getting shot and wounded last night.
Well,
this is going to be
that.
A long, hot summer, Howard.
We've got that. We've got the Iran nuclear negotiations. If Benjamin Netanyahu is correct, they could be a disaster. If Barack Obama is right, then we should all calm down. But I tend to believe that they can be a disaster. We have the fact, even a relative victory, the fact that the Iraqis seem to be in the process of taking over Tikrit, the city in which Saddam Hussein was born,
That's right.
which would be a major victory against ISIS. Even that has its edgy part, because that whole military exercise is being led by Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani, who is an Iranian, and it's part of Iran's very slow takeover, not only of Iraq, but Iran is working to become a superpower in the Middle East, and the Saudis and the people in the Gulf states are nervous as could possibly be. You want to talk about uptight people, take a look at a Saudi contemplating what's going on with Iran's radical growth and the possible basically ratification of Iran's growth by the Obama administration.
Good point. Howard's website, howardbloom.net. It's part of our Twitter feed. If you're not following us on Twitter, do so by going to coasttocoastam.com. And while you're there, take a look at the pictures that Robert Morningstar has sent us. Anomalies on the Moon. We're going to talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Morningstar with us this hour, civilian intelligence analyst, psychotherapist in the city of New York. Received a degree in psychology from Fordham. He also has studied the paranormal, UFOs, for more than 40 years. He is also the associate editor of UFO Digest, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. Robert, by popular demand, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm glad people are demanding.
I love these images that you sent us that Lex has posted on the coasttocoastam.com website.
Well, yes, I'm very happy to present them. One is familiar to you, the one that's labeled Big Ben on the Moon, the second one. The one that's in the first place is a photo that I discovered after the San Francisco conference, the Secret Space Program Breakaway Civilization conference. And I've continued searching for towers on the moon, and I'm very gratified that people heard me. They've heard me on your show calling for more people to go into research. I've said that a million eyes are better than, you know, a thousand or a hundred or even two good eyes. And people have taken that message, and wonderful YouTube videos are being released by leakers. One of my favorite people in YouTube in this lunar anomaly studies is Luna Cognita. That's the anonymous name of a person who has access to remarkable resources, and he posts them. It seems like we work in tandem, you know. I've mentioned Big Ben on the Moon, and he's continued to bring out videos of anomalies in the Apollo photographs. I forwarded a link just go to YouTube and study the work of Luna Cognita, which means the known moon. As opposed to...
Yeah, it sounded like some Russian informant.
he's actually a North American.
Is he? Okay.
Yeah.
Robert...
He wants to remain anonymous, and so I'm happy to give him cover, but I'm also happy to bring what he's found to the general public.
These...
And there are others, and I'll mention them as we go along. They deserve a lot of credit.
These anomalies on the moon, how long have they been there, in your opinion?
They're not modern. Some are archaic, and some, which I haven't shown you yet, I'm waiting to spring something, maybe this springtime around JFK's birthday. I found an arch bridge on the far side of the moon. I've been working with some really high quality Clementine photographs, the best I've ever seen, and one of them is compiled from 22.5 million individual frames from Clementine, color photos in great detail, and it's remarkable what is now being allowed to come up. And Luna Cognita, in this particular video that I sent the link to Lex for posting, he really goes in depth into, he gives the numbers of the photographs from the Apollo missions.
Mm-hmm.
I have a long list that I wish to publish for people, you know, who have at least 10 of them here. You know, they go with numbers like Apollo 9-213212. I call that thing a moon bat. It's an Apollo spacecraft in an inverted position, color photograph. And below it is something, some winged thing below it. So I've sat down with Luna Cognita and jotted down all of the numbers. And I encourage people to do that. We're living in a wonderful time for independent research. And I encourage everyone to just dive into whatever you like, whatever your topic, your subject.
Ironically, Michael Cremo is following you tonight, talking about how old he believes mankind to be. Is it possible that the anomalies we're talking about on the moon might have been made, might have been put there by Earthlings, by humans?
It's quite possible.
Long time
I always
ago.
Point out to people that, you know, you ought to read other people's histories, because our history is so slanted. It's slanted. It's artificial. Only when you read a lot of different people's histories do you really get a chance to understand world history and the history of the Indian people, the Hindu civilization. The Mahabharata tells of a war between the people of the earth and the people of the moon. And I've related on the show here to you the story of the Emperor Xuanzong, who claimed to have been taken to the moon in a moon ship and have seen wonderful dances and heard wonderful music. So I believe that it is possible that, listen, this is the most remarkable thing. Man has been evolving for 1.5 million years, and according to our timeline, 10,000 years ago, we were in the caves, and we've come out of the caves and onto the moon in 10,000 years. That is a flash. I mean, it's
nothing. That's
it's
right.
Insignificant fraction of time. And so given that, and knowing man's been around for 1.5 million years, it could have been done several times already. Several times in the past.
Well, I think something horrible happened on this planet, Robert, that obliterated mankind, whether it was man-made or natural.
Right.
But it's probably happened several times, and here we are in another evolution. So, when we went to the moon in 1969, it was an amazing accomplishment, but
yes.
I think we've been there before.
Others, I'm quite certain now. You know, as these things I'm finding, some of them don't look human-made. You know, I do study a lot of insectology, specifically for this reason that some of the extraterrestrials seem to be insectoid, others seem to be reptilian.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, working in the natural world, for example, having a vivarium where I have three lizards, black beetles, you know, earthworms, and watching all of that interaction, and then communicating with these creatures, as I do with the lizards, for example, getting to know them, introducing yourself by giving them water or touch, all kinds of things. So I do study this, and I look at the moon, and I see things, architecture, that I would consider insectoid. If you've ever spent time in the tropics or seen termite nests.
Termite tunnels, I've seen termite, some of those.
Big stacks, almost like smokestack structures that you see in Central Africa, you start to recognize non-human architecture, let's call it that. You know, there's one photo, the Zond lander, the one that landed near the crater, the very first one, The very first time I saw that picture, it gave me the creeps. Because it looked to me like a hermit, a horseshoe crab was crawling around. And there's all these tracks on the ground that looked to me insectoid. And so I have this curiosity, and I do delve into it very deeply. And these towers, the towers were first recorded by the Russians in the early Luna and Zond missions.
How tall are the towers, Robert?
Oh, they vary from miles to many, many, many miles.
Are these the glass tubes, or is this something else?
Well, they are sections that look tubular, but these are spires.
Okay.
You can see the one that I called Big Ben on the Moon. I named it because it looks like a cross between Big Ben and the Empire State Building. And it is a spired structure. It tapers up. It's symmetrical. And in the photos that I've sent you, I've sent different views. Mm-hmm. The first two, I believe, are the same, one in daytime and one is the night shot from the Apollo spacecraft. And then there's an orbital photo over the Mare Crisium showing a huge monolithic object and then a close-up of it. So it keeps they keep popping up. I don't know if I have a psychic sense. I seem to,
yes, you do,
to be guided. I don't know. My finger sometimes flicks, hits the mouse accidentally, and an amazing thing will pop up. So I like to share this because it really does belong to the world. And I think it's a marvelous thing to contemplate how many times Earth beings have gotten to the moon and how many times we've destroyed ourselves. You know that one of my favorite finds of the last year was Hiroshima on the moon, and that area near the Mare Orientale, vast area of devastation. And I'm sure that Carl Wolf, whom you may know from the Disclosure group, he testified that he had seen photographs, U.S. Air Force, he was a technician, repairing a digital copy machine at Langley Air Force Base. And the serviceman who was working with him while he repaired the machine said to him, you know, we found bases on the far side of the moon. And he said, oh, yeah. And he didn't really want to hear it because he knew that this was classified information and that he wasn't supposed to be privy to it. But the guy kept talking. He said, yeah, you want to see? Look at this. And he showed him these photographs. And Carl Wolf says that he actually started shaking with nerves, knowing that he wasn't supposed to be seeing these photographs. He wasn't being supposed to be told these things. But the weight of solitary knowledge in this other airman, you know, you unload, as you say, you know, you unload the weight by sharing it. So Carl Wolf said that he saw photographs of areas of the moon that had buildings with triangular tops and columns, all of the same height and the same diameter. And that is precisely what I found in the Chinese photographs from the Chang'e 2 moon probe, which I released on Coast to Coast last year. So I feel that my work, you know, it validates people like Carl Wolf. There you go. I show you that. What's called Hiroshima on the Moon. Three triangular towers, columns, all of the same size, same height, and the same diameter, and architecture, visible architecture, just as if you saw photographs of Hiroshima from the air in 1945.
Right, or Berlin or London after, you know, during the war.
Right, exactly so. So I'm very happy to know these things, but I'm also happy to bring the message to people, which is a warning that whoever that was on the moon that built those towers with triangular tops and columnar towers of the same height and the same diameter as seen by Carl Wolf, something happened then. Either they destroyed themselves or they were destroyed.
It could be a lesson for us. Robert, stay with us. We're going to hit the break and come right back. We'll talk more about this secret space program. We'll also take phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Morningstar, our special guest, UFODigest.com. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Hey, have you had a chance yet to look at our television program, Beyond Belief? It's a streamed program, and you can watch it for free for a while by going to this website and fill out the information, www.beyondbelief.com. Beyondbelief.com. Take a look at the program we did with David Wilcock. You can go back and look at all the past shows, by the way, as many as you want. That was the highest rated program there that they've had. Beyondbelief.com. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Morningstar with us, of course, and we'll take your calls as well. Robert, the secret space program, when you were at the conference, did you have a chance to meet Catherine Austin Fitz? She was out there too.
We met briefly. It was a very busy time, but I saw her presentation and the exposure of the hijacking of the national economy and the exporting of the national wealth to fund, apparently, a secret space program. There were many marvelous presentations, dissertations. Richard Dolan, Mark McCandless, John Rappaport, Carol Rosen.
Super people.
And the videos have just been released to YouTube, so I encourage everyone on Facebook to go to Secret Space Program, Breakaway Civilization website or Facebook page, and take in the YouTube videos and the lectures given by this great group of experts.
How long do you think this Secret Space Program's been around? Since the beginning of the space program?
Before. I think that there were military space programs that were working in the dark as early in, as early 1950s. The Corona surveillance satellite program is one example. The CIA sent up a satellite with the highest highest resolution cameras, and then would capture the film as it was dropped from space. And that's how we knew exactly how many bombers and ICBMs the Russians had during the 1950s. So that was a secret space program. But the technology part of it has been, it was compartmentalized. Some of it was Air Force research, foreign technology. Foreign technology division is what handles crashed UFOs because a UFO is a foreign technology, so it fits very nicely into that category without drawing a lot of attention. And then, of course, the CIA, the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy has had a long-running program since the 1940s in reverse engineering UFOs, particularly because they retrieved the UFO from the Battle of L.A. That one was pursued by airplanes after it left the Los Angeles area heading toward Catalina.
That was a great story.
Oh, yeah. I just found the best copy of that of the photograph of the Battle of L.A., and it reaffirms my conviction that those spotlights are only hitting a small part of the craft.
Not the whole thing.
Not the whole thing.
Wow.
And that the whole thing is really a black triangle. I've read accounts from an 8-year-old boy who saw it with his mother, and he said that they saw a lozenge-shaped spacecraft or vehicle. It had no wings. It was glowing slightly orange, but it was shaped like a diamond. And in this, what I call best photograph, a best resolution photograph of the Battle of L.A. that I've yet come across, just in recent days, by the way, it confirmed something that I had been looking at in the other lesser quality photographs, but a black triangle UFO, and it is so huge that the spotlights are converging on only one small part of it, and in converging and overlapping are illuminating one part, which is creating this dome effect, but it's only a little piece of the craft itself. So apparently that thing was hit and was damaged and crashed near Catalina, and the United States Navy is supposed to have recovered the submerged crash and had been working on reverse engineering that since 1942.
Robert, why keep the program secret? From us, from the Soviets at the time, why keep it secret?
Well, that was one thing, is to keep it from the Soviets was a very important element they didn't want the Soviets to think that we even believed in UFOs, because they were afraid the Soviets would jump into that field and send, start snooping around trying to steal our UFO secrets. If they believed that the government had no belief in it, was spending no money in it, then they would not likely try to challenge or surpass us in that field. But the fact is, the Russians have had their own crashes for a long period of time and have had interactions. And to me, they seem to be the most forthright about the existence of UFOs and their catalog of the various races that have been visiting Earth since time immemorial. They see it in historical terms as, like Jacques Vallée.
Yeah.
You can look at it as a local phenomenon that just started in 1947, but if you look at it, the long view, the historical view, and you see how language changes over time, that the language of the Bible and the language of the Middle Ages was trying to encompass, an unknown. And just as now we use the term extraterrestrial or alien or interdimensional, they would use terms like angels, demons, goblins, and so on. And going back into ancient times, the ancient gods of Egypt or the Hindu gods.
Okay, let's go to the phones for you. They're starting to line up in the moments we have left. We'll go to Toronto in Ontario, Canada. Kim is with us on the international line. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Hi. It's so great to talk to you, George.
You too. Glad you got through.
Okay. Wondering if your guest knows anything about the religions that speak of the golden age to come, if that's something he's looked into, we're going to be entering 1,000 years of peace where the lion lays down with the lamb and people will once again
sounds
be very kind and compassionate to the animals, the planet. Have you heard of this?
Oh, I've heard about it for a long time. It's a promise that's given in every great prophecy, from
Book of Revelation, isn't
it? The Book of Revelations to the Central Asian legend of the coming of Maitreya. Let's call him the Christ of the Asians is the Maitreya, the Christ that's to come for Asia. So it's the same utopia, the same idea of universal brotherhood. But, let me warn you that legends and myths can be hijacked to bad purposes. And I mentioned this one because the Shambhala myth was hijacked by the Soviet Union to overcome Central Asia and conquer the Mongolians and the people of Central Asia, like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. They had a myth since the 12th century of a coming of Shambhala. A kingdom would spring in the north, which would bring forth universal brotherhood and peace and love to all humanity. And it spread from the 12th century into the 20th century. And the Soviets, when they found out that this legend existed, had this brilliant idea to convince the Central Asians that they were Shambhala, that the Communist Revolution had been the birth of the prophecy of Shambhala, and that they should join in because they were the keepers of the tradition and the fulfillers of the prophecy. And they overran Central Asia by convincing Mongolian tribes and Kazakhstani tribes that they were the promise. So we got to be careful with how myths are manipulated to manipulate us. And I see that happening now. I do look forward to the kingdom of heavenly peace, and I believe it will come. But there's a whole staging of world events that's going on right now that seems to be geared to fulfilling those prophecies that are necessary before that kingdom comes forth, and one of those is the Armageddon and the war between Gog and Magog. So let's be careful. We don't have to fulfill prophecy to the letter.
Right, and it'll be a bouncy road to get there, won't it?
It certainly will.
Next up, we go to Chuck in Indianapolis, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Chuck. You're up with us.
Good morning. Good morning.
Hi.
I have to say is when I was in the Air Force in the early 50s, we flew the stratosphere constantly, and when we came, made our reports and debriefing, we're not allowed to put in the reports or even say anything about what we saw.
Right.
And they swore you to secrecy, which I carry today. I will not repeat. And that's I was in SAC, and as you know, we flew to stratosphere every day.
Yeah.
We're on a bomber that could go from here to Russia and back without refueling.
Yeah,
that's
true.
That was the B-36.
I was going to ask you, were you in the Peacemaker?
Yes, I was.
Man, that's amazing. For those who don't know, this gentleman, this airman, was flying on that remarkable Flying Cigar. It was the biggest airplane in the world at the time. It had both jets and props.
Four props, too, didn't it?
Right.
Yeah,
and then it had two jet engines as well. And I've heard stories about flying in the stratosphere with the props where snow or ice would congeal on the propellers, and the propellers would sling them right into the fuselage, and they'd come flying through the fuselage like cannon fire. I salute you, sir, for your service.
Let's ask Chuck if he ever had a rough time on that plane. Chuck?
I loved it.
You did?
I loved the plane. We had a large crew. The propellers were 30 feet long.
Jeez.
Tip, there were six recips, and there were pushers. We had four jets,
right,
two on each wingtip.
Four jets.
And our tail section, the vertical tail, was 30 feet.
Monster.
And that's how gives you an idea how large that aircraft was, and it kept us out of war because the B-52 and the 47 had to refuel in the middle of their flights, and they were sitting ducks, but not us.
Did you ever have a scary moment there, Chuck, on that plane?
I can't.
You can't talk. You know, Chuck, I'm really glad you called in and mentioned this, because, folks, right here before us, we have this gentleman who is bound by secrecy in the same way that all the astronauts are bound by secrecy. You know, you are true to your oath.
He sure is, all these years.
Keeping it. In the same manner, you have to tiptoe in a conversation when you're asked direct questions. And I say that, you know, there ought to be a congressional law passed that will give the astronauts freedom to speak, exonerate them, or relieve them from their oath.
That'll never happen, Robert.
Well, we can hope, we can pray, and we can actually write to your congressman and tell him to get on that.
Even Edgar Mitchell, whom I admire,
sure,
kind of tippy-toes around certain things. He's trying.
Yes, I had my own experience with him about it. You know, he refused to answer a question that I posed about describing the internal structure of the crater Ukert, and it changed radically. And, you know, it was a kind of reflexive thing, and it just showed me that there's a grip, you know. The gentleman here, there's a grip. When you asked him about having any unusual experiences, the secrecy grip comes in. I can't talk too openly about
it. It kicks right in, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I'm afraid that the astronauts are still operating under the same constraints, and they should be relieved of it.
Let's go to Marie in San Francisco, west of the Rockies. Hello, Marie.
Hey, hi, George. Good. And Robert. So glad to
get
through. And Robert, you mentioned about insect-like structures on the moon, and a personal theory of mine for many years has been the fact that Earth is often called the library, and that perhaps that all the species that are on Earth have developed into intelligent life somewhere in the universe, like the American Indian legends of ant people and snake people. And
well,
I'm wondering if you've ever considered that.
Well, I think that the ant people and the snake people are, as I said before, about language, struggling to express an unknown, and I think this legends of the ant people and the snake people are an attempt by the Native Americans who encountered these beings to describe them in terms that were familiar to them in their culture. And whereas we would say, you know, I went to the Southwest near Dulce and I encountered a gray alien, they would say, we were near Dulce Mountain and we saw one of the ant people. And so we're all talking about the same thing, but just using different adjectives to describe it.
Robert, what's your next project?
Well, I'm working on the JFK project, and I'm very gratified to see this movie doing very well on YouTube. It's a monumental film called JFK to 9/11. Everything is a rich man's trick. I was watching this very, very accurate account, the history of the JFK assassination before the events, the history leading up to it, the event itself, and then in utter shock and dismay, I saw my picture appear and the gentleman starts describing my work that Beautiful. I've described to you on Officer Tippett.
You deserve it. Let's go to Jim, truck driving in Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, I just want to ask you, guest Robert, he was talking about the Battle of L.A. I was wondering if he was familiar with the fight that happened around Sanford, Florida a couple of years ago. Sanford's a small town between Orlando and Daytona Beach. There was this huge plane. It was the largest plane I've ever seen, and it was fighting these two smaller planes. It was too far away to determine if they were planes, but the maneuvers that they were doing, I've never seen it do before. Those two small planes were actually doing circles around a big plane, shooting green lasers at the big plane, and it was on fire. That's how I saw it. I just saw this ball of fire in the sky, and this was literally right over the Sanford International Airport. And then the big plane was shooting blue lasers at the small planes, and the big plane did take down the smaller plane with its blue lasers, but it also went down because it was also on fire. I was just wondering if your guest knew about that.
You know, I am not familiar with that happening in Sanford, Florida, but if you had said that to me without telling me where it was, I would have said to you that sounds like the battle that took place over Kelowna Lake in Canada, up in British Columbia a couple of years ago. A similar aerial dogfight was observed between two different types of UFO craft. And I've heard about it going on in different parts of the country and different parts of the world, but this is a new case to me, and I would like to know more about it, so perhaps I'll follow up and see if there's anything written.
I think it happened around 2010 or so, Robert.
I remember something around that time, but the one that stands out in my mind are the craft that were fighting over a lake in British Columbia.
Yeah, I remember
and
that.
One zapped the other, and the thing went into the lake. And I recently released on my eStream a video that was taken up in British Columbia of a UFO coming out of the water, going vertically straight up into the sky, and you can see the water follow the UFO up and up like a giant gusher, and then sinking back down with a big plunge, like a big drop. So there's a lot of great video coming out. Third Phase of the Moon did a wonderful job on this Manitoba UFO event.
They're just everywhere. These cases, Robert, are just everywhere.
And it's great that people share them. This is really the only way for us to really get to know what's going on. As I've said to everyone that I speak to, it's not the government who's going to tell us about UFOs. It's we who are going to tell the government UFOs.
Robert, thanks for being on the program. Appreciate
it. My pleasure, George.
Robert Morningstar's website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Michael Cremo joins us for a full program, The Forbidden Archaeologist. We'll talk a little bit, get his reaction to a 2.8-million-year-old jawbone fragment that was found, and some other fascinating things for you right here on Coast to Coast AM. And also, don't forget to email me at george@coasttocoastam.com.